local and online shops that will print shirts or hats with a logo on it. A few minutes of aligning things on a template, and he ordered a shirt and ball cap with the logo of the waste company on it. A couple of days later, wearing the logo-laden clothing and carrying a clipboard, the social engineer approached the security booth of the Target company. He said, "Hi, I'm Joe with ABC Waste. We got a call from your purchasing department asking to send someone over to check out a damaged dumpster in the back. The pickup is tomorrow, and if the dumpster isn't repairable, I will have them bring out a new one. But I need to run back there and inspect it." Without blinking, the security officer said, "Okay, you'll need this badge to get on site. Just pull through here and drive around back, and you'll see the dumpsters there." The social engineer had a free pass to perform a very long and detailed dumpster dive, but wanted to maximize his potential, so went in for the kill with this line. While looking at his clipboard, he said, "The note says it's not the food dumpster, but one of the ones where the paper or tech trash goes. Which block are those in?" "Oh, just drive the same way I told you, and they are in the third bay," replied the security guard. "Thanks," said Joe. A simple pretext, backed up by clothing and tools like the clipboard, and the storylines were simple to remember and not complex. The simplicity and lack of detail actually made this pretext more believable, and it worked. Another very widely used pretext is that of the tech support guy. This one only requires a polo shirt, pair of khakis, and a small computer tool bag. Many social engineers employ this tactic to get in the front door because the tech guy is usually given access to everything without supervision. The same rules apply. Keeping the storyline simple will help make this particular pretext very real and believable. The pretext should appear spontaneous. Making the pretext appear spontaneous goes back to my point of using an outline versus using a script. Outlines will always allow the social engineer more freedom, and a script will make the social engineer sound too robotic. It also ties into using items or stories that interest the social engineer personally. If every time someone asks you a question or makes a statement that requires you to think, and you go, and start to think deeply, and you cannot come back with an intelligent answer, it will ruin your credibility. Of course, many people think before they speak. So this is not about having the answer in 1 second, but about having an answer or a reason for not having the answer. For example, in one phone call, I was asked for a piece of information I didn't have. I simply said, "Let me get that." I then leaned over and made it sound like I was yelling for a workmate. "Jill, can you please ask Bill to give me the order form for the XYZ account? Thanks." Then, as Jill was getting the paper for me, I was able to obtain the data I needed, and the paper was never brought up again. I have compiled a small list of ways that you can work on being more spontaneous. Don't think about how you feel. This point is a good one, because often in a pretext, if you overthink, you will start to add emotion into the mix, which can cause fear, nervousness, or anxiety, all of which lead to failure. On the other hand, you might not experience nervousness or fear, but overexcitement, which can also cause you to make a lot of mistakes. Don't take yourself too seriously. Of course, this is great advice in life, but it applies wonderfully to social engineering. As a security professional, you have a serious job. This is a serious matter. But if you're not able to laugh at your mistakes, you may clam up or get too nervous to handle a small bump in the road. I am not suggesting you take security as a joke. In your mind, though, if you view a potential failure as a pinnacle of failure in your life, the pressure you create can cause just what you fear the most. Minor failures can often lead to greater successes if you have the ability to roll with it. Learn to identify what is relevant. I like to phrase this concept as get out of your head and into the world, which is more great advice. A social engineer may be trying to plan 3 steps ahead, and in the meantime miss a vital detail that can cause the pretext to fall apart. Be quick to identify the relevant material and information around you, whether it is the target's body language, words spoken, or micro-expressions, see Chapter 5 for more on this topic, and assimilate the information into the attack vector. Also keep in mind that people can tell when someone isn't really listening to what they are saying. Getting the feeling that even unimportant sentences are falling on deaf ears can be a massive turnoff for many people. Everyone has experienced being with someone who just didn't seem to care what he or she was saying. Maybe that person even had a legitimate reason to be thinking on a different path, but doing it is still a turnoff. Be sure to listen to what your target is saying, pay close attention, and you will pick up the details that are very important to them. And, in the meantime, you might hear something to help you in your success. Seek to gain experience. This concept goes back to what you will probably see repeated 4 million times in this book. Practice. Gaining experience through practice can make or break the pretext. Practice spontaneity with your family and friends and total strangers with absolutely no goal in mind but to be spontaneous. Strike up conversations with people, but not in a scary stalker kind of way. Simple, little conversations go a long way toward making you feel comfortable being spontaneous. These points can definitely give a social engineer the upper hand when it comes to pretexting. Having the ability to appear spontaneous is a gift. Earlier in this chapter, I mentioned my interview with Tom Mischke, who had an interesting take on spontaneity. He said he wants to give the illusion of spontaneity wrapped in practice and preparation. He would practice so much that his pretext would come out as a spontaneous generation of humor and talent. Provide a logical conclusion or follow through for the target. Believe it or not, people want to be told what to do. Imagine if you went to a doctor and he walked in, checked you over, wrote some things on his chart, and said, "Okay, see you in a month." That would be unacceptable. Even in the event of bad news, people want to be told the next step and what to do. As a social engineer, when you leave the target, you may need him to take or not take an action. Or you may have gotten what you came for and just need to leave. Whatever the circumstance, giving the target a conclusion or follow-through fills in the expected gaps for the target. Just as if a doctor checked you over and sent you home with no directions, if you engineer your way into a facility as a tech support guy and just walk out without saying anything to anyone after cloning the database, you leave everyone wondering what happened. Someone may even call the tech support company and ask whether he needed to do anything, or at worst, you just leave the workers wondering. Either way, leaving everyone hanging is not the way to leave. Even a simple, "I checked over the servers and repaired the file system," you should see a 22% increase in speed over the next couple of days. Leaves the targets feeling as if they got their money's worth. The tricky part for a social engineer is getting the target to take an action after he or she is gone. If the action is vital for completion of the social engineer audit, then you may want to take that role upon yourself. For example, in the account on Chapter 3 of my information gathering session at the Chamber of Commerce event, if I wanted that target to follow up with me through email, I could have said, "Here is my card. Will you email me some details on Monday about XYZ? He very well may have, or he could have gone to the office, forgotten about me completely, and the whole gig would have failed. What would be better is to say, "I would love to get some more information from you. On Monday, could I perhaps call you or shoot you an email to get some more details?" The requests you make should match the pretext, too. If your pretext is being a tech support guy, you won't order people around with what they must and must not do. You work for them. If you are a UPS delivery person, you don't demand access to the server room. As mentioned earlier, more steps may exist for perfecting a pretext. But the ones listed in this chapter can give a social engineer a solid foundation to build a perfectly believable pretext. You might be asking, okay, so you listed all these principles, but now what? How can a social engineer build a well-researched, believable, spontaneous-sounding, simple pretext that can work either on the phone or in person and get the desired results? Listen on. Successful pretexting. To learn how to build a successful pretext, here are a couple of stories of social engineers who used pretexts that worked and how they developed them. Eventually, they did get caught, which is why these stories are now available. Example 1. Stanley Mark Rifkin. Stanley Mark Rifkin is credited with one of the biggest bank heists in American history. Rifkin was a computer geek who ran a computer consulting business out of his small apartment. One of his clients was a company that serviced the computers at a Security Pacific bank. The 55-floor Security Pacific National Bank headquarters in Los Angeles looked like a granite and glass fortress. Dark-suited guards roamed the lobby, and hidden cameras photographed customers as they made deposits and withdrawals. This building seemed impenetrable. So how is it that Rifkin walked away with $10.2 million and never held a gun, never touched a dollar, and never held up anyone? The bank's wire transfer policies seemed secure. They were authorized by a numerical code that changed daily and was only given out to authorized personnel. It was posted on a wall in a secure room that only authorized personnel had access to. Here's an excerpt from an archived article. In October 1978, he visited Security Pacific, where bank employees easily recognized him as a computer worker. He took an elevator to the D level, where the bank's wire transfer room was located. A pleasant and friendly young man, he managed to talk his way into the room where the bank's secret code of the day was posted on the wall. Rifkin memorized the code and left without arousing suspicion. Soon, bank employees in the transfer room received a call from a man who identified himself as Mike Hansen, an employee of the bank's international division. The man ordered a routine transfer of funds into an account at the Irving Trust Company in New York, and he provided the secret code numbers to authorize the transaction. Nothing about the transfer appeared to be out of the ordinary, and Security Pacific transferred the money to the New York bank. What bank officials did not know was that the man who called himself Mike Hansen was in fact Stanley Rifkin, and he had used the bank's security code to rob the bank of $10.2 million. This scenario offers much to talk about, but for now, focus on the pretext. Think about the details of what he had to do. He had to be confident and comfortable in order to not raise suspicion for being in that room. He had to have a believable story when he called to do the transfer and have the details to back up the story. He had to be spontaneous enough to go with the flow with the questions that might have come up. He had to also be smooth enough not to raise suspicion. This pretext had to be meticulously planned out, with the utmost detail being thought through. It wasn't until he visited a former associate that his pretext failed and he was caught. When he was caught, people who knew him were amazed, and some even said things like, "There is no way he's a thief. Everyone loves Mark." Obviously, his pretext was solid. He had a well-thought-out, and one would guess, well-rehearsed plan. He knew what he was there to do, and he played the part perfectly. When he was in front of strangers, he was able to play the part. His downfall came when he was with a colleague who knew him, and that colleague saw a news story, then put two and two together and turned Mark in. Amazingly enough, while out on bail, Rifkin began to target another bank using the same scheme. But a government mole had set him up. He got caught and spent 8 years in federal prison. Although Mark is a bad guy, you can learn much about pretexting from reading his story. He kept it very simple and used the things that were familiar to him to build a good storyline. Mark's plan was to steal the money and turn it into an untraceable commodity, diamonds. To do so, he would first need to be a bank employee to steal the money. Then, a major diamond buyer to unload the cash. And finally, sell the diamonds to have usable, untraceable cash in his pocket. Although his pretext did not involve elaborate costumes or speech patterns, he had to play the part of a bank employee, then major diamond buyer, then play the part of a diamond seller. He changed roles maybe 3, 4, or 5 times in this gig, and was able to do it well enough to fool almost everyone. Mark knew who his targets were and approached the scenario with all the principles outlined earlier. Of course, one can't condone what he did, but his pretexting talents are admirable. If he put his talents to good use, he would probably make a great public figure, salesperson, or actor. Example 2. Hewlett-Packard. In 2006, Newsweek published a very interesting article. Basically, HP's chairwoman, Patricia Dunn, hired a team of security specialists who hired a team of private investigators who used pretexting to obtain phone records. These hired professionals actually got in and played the roles of HP board members and parts of the press. All of this was done to uncover a supposed information leak within the ranks at HP. Ms. Dunn wanted to obtain the phone records of board members and reporters. Not the records from the HP facilities, but the personal home and cell phone records of these people. To verify where she supposed the leak was, the Newsweek article states, on May 18th at HP headquarters in Palo Alto, California, Dunn sprung her bombshell on the board. She had found the leaker. According to Tom Perkins, an HP director who was present, Dunn laid out the surveillance scheme and pointed out the offending director, who acknowledged being the CNET leaker. That director, whose identity has not yet been publicly disclosed, apologized. But the director then said to fellow directors, "I would have told you all about this. Why didn't you just ask?" That director was then asked to leave the boardroom, and did so, according to Perkins. What is notable about this account is what is next mentioned about the topic of pretexting. The HP case specifically also sheds another spotlight on the questionable tactics used by security consultants to obtain personal information. HP acknowledged in an internal email sent from its outside counsel to Perkins that it got the paper trail it needed to link the director leaker to CNET through a controversial practice called pretexting. Newsweek obtained a copy of that email. That practice, according to the Federal Trade Commission, involves using false pretenses to get another individual's personal, non-public information, telephone records, bank and credit card account numbers, social security numbers, and the like. Typically, say in the case of a phone company, pretexters call and falsely represent themselves as the customer, since companies rarely require passwords. A pretexter may need no more than a home address, account number, and a heartfelt plea to get the details of an account. According to the Federal Trade Commission's website, pretexters sell the information to individuals who can range from otherwise legitimate private investigators, financial lenders, potential litigants, and suspicious spouses to those who might attempt to steal assets or fraudulently obtain credit. Pretexting, the FTC site states, is against the law. The FTC and several state attorneys general have brought enforcement actions against pretexters for allegedly violating federal and state laws on fraud, misrepresentation, and unfair competition. One of HP's directors is Larry Babbio, the president of Verizon, which has filed various actions against pretexters. The end result was that criminal charges were brought not only against Dunn, but against the consultants she hired. You may wonder, how is that possible considering they were hired and contracted to perform these tests? Take a look at what avenues they used and what information they obtained to help answer this question. Consultants obtained the names, addresses, social security numbers, telephone call logs, telephone billing records, and other information of the HP board members and reporters. They actually used the Social Security number to establish an online account for one reporter and then obtain records of his personal calls. Page 32 of a confidential document from Hewlett-Packard to its lawyer and internal legal staff lists a communication from Tom Perkins to the HP board members that offers a little more insight about what pretexts were used. A few tactics used were, they represented themselves as the carrier company to obtain the records of calls illegally. The identities of the ones being investigated were used and spoofed to obtain their personal call records. Online accounts with carriers were generated using illegally obtained names, social security numbers, and other information to access their call records. On September 11, 2006, the United States House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce sent Ms. Dunn a letter requesting the information she had obtained. They listed in their requests the obtained information as the following: all published and non-published telephone numbers, credit card bills, customer name and address info, utility bills, pager numbers, cell numbers, social security numbers, credit reports, post office box information, bank account information, asset information, other consumer information. All of this information was obtained through a very gray area of professional social engineering. Is what they did ethical and moral, even though they were hired to do it? Many professional social engineers would not go to these lengths. The lesson to be learned from this very important case is that as a professional social engineer, you might mimic the methodologies and the thinking of malicious social engineers, but never should you stoop completely to their levels. The problem with these consultants came in that they were authorized to pretext, social engineer, and audit Hewlett-Packard. They were not authorized to social engineer AT&T, Verizon, utility companies, and so on. When employing pretexting, you must have it outlined and planned so you know what legal lines you might get near and what lines you must not cross. HP's story lends itself to a discussion about policy, contracts, and outlining what you will be offering if you are a social engineer auditor. But these topics are not within the context of this chapter. Using the principles outlined so far in this chapter can help you make decisions that will keep you out of trouble. The danger with malicious pretexting is the threat of identity theft, which makes it a very valid part of a social engineer pen test. Testing, checking, and verifying that your client's employees will not fall for the methods used by malicious social engineers can go a long way in safeguarding you from a successful pretexter. Staying legal. In 2005, Private Investigator magazine was granted an interview with Joel Winston, Associate Director of the Federal Trade Commission, Division of Financial Practices. His office is in charge of regulating and monitoring the use of pretexting. Here are some of the key points from this interview. Pretexting, according to the FTC, is the obtaining of any information from a bank or consumer, not just financial information, using fraud, deception, or misleading questions to obtain such information. Using already obtained information to verify that a target is a target, even while using false pretenses, is legal under the FTC's definition of pretexting, unless the social engineer is using this information to obtain information from a financial institution. Acquiring toll phone or cellular records through deceptive business practices is considered illegal pretexting. The FTC website provides some clarity and additional information to this interview. It is illegal for anyone to use false, fictitious, or fraudulent statements or documents to get customer information from a financial institution or directly from a customer of a financial institution. It is illegal for anyone to use forged, counterfeit, lost, or stolen documents to get customer information from a financial institution or directly from a customer of a financial institution. It is illegal for anyone to ask another person to get someone else's customer information using false, fictitious, or fraudulent statements or using false, fictitious, or fraudulent documents or forged, counterfeit, lost, or stolen documents. Although the FTC's focus is on financial institutions, the guidelines outlined are a reminder of what is considered illegal in the United States. Looking into their local laws and making sure they are not breaking those laws is a good idea for professional social engineers. In 2006, the Federal Trade Commission moved to expand Section 5 of the FTC Act to specifically include a law banning the use of pretexting to retrieve telephone records. HP's pretexting situation ended in one of the private investigators being charged with conspiracy and federal identity theft. Very serious charges. Keeping pretexting legal will entail some research on the part of the professional social engineer, as well as a clearly defined and signed off plan of what pretexts, if any, will be used. Despite the legal matters mentioned earlier, using a solid pretext is one of the quickest ways into a company. Pretexting is a talent all its own, and, as you can see from this chapter, is not simply putting on a wig or a pair of fake glasses and pretending you are someone you're not. Additional pretexting tools. Other tools exist that can enhance a pretext. Props can go a long way in convincing a target of the reality of your pretext. For example, magnetic signs for your vehicle, matching uniforms or outfits, tools or other carry-ons, and the most important, a business card. The power of the business card hit me when I was recently flying to Las Vegas on business. My laptop bag usually gets scanned, rescanned, then swabbed for bomb dust or whatever. I am one of those guys who doesn't really mind the extra security precautions because they keep me from blowing up in the air, and I'm happy with that. Yet I realize that 90% of the time, I'm going to get extra attention by Transportation Security Administration. On this particular trip, I had forgotten to take my lockpicks, RFID scanner, 4 extra hard drives, bump keys, see Chapter 7, and plethora of wireless hacking gear out of my carry-on laptop bag. As it goes through the scanner, I hear the lady working the x-ray say, "What the heck?" She then calls over another gentleman who stares at the screen and says, "I have no clue what the heck that stuff is." He then looks around, sees my smiling face, and says, "Is this you?" I walk over to the table with him as he is emptying my RFID scanner and my large case of lockpicks, and he says, "Why do you have all of these items, and what are they?" I had nothing planned, but decided at the last second to try this move. I pulled out a business card and said, "I am a security professional who specializes in testing networks, buildings, and people for security holes. These are the tools of my business." I said this as I handed him a business card, and he looked at it for about 5 seconds and then said, "Oh, excellent. Thanks for the explanation." He then neatly put all my items back in, zipped the bag up, and let me go. Usually, I go through the bomb screening, the little dust machine, and then a pat-down. But this time, all I got was a thank you and a quick release. I began to analyze what I did differently than normal. The only difference was that I had given them a business card. Granted, my business card is not the $9.99 special from an online card printer, but I was amazed that what seemed to have happened was that a business card added a sense of license to my claims. I purposely packed every hacking device into my bags I could find, and then kept a business card in my pocket. Each time my bag was examined and I was asked about the contents, I flipped out the card. Each time I was apologized to, had my items packed in neatly, and let go. I imagine my experience was a pretext. Little details can add so much weight to what I am saying that I can appear valid, trustworthy, and solid with nothing more than a card that tells people that everything I say is true. Don't underestimate the power of a business card. One word of caution. Getting a weak and pathetic-looking business card can actually cause the opposite effect. A business card that was free with an advertisement on the back will not add weight to a professional pretext. Yet there is no reason to spend $300 on a business card to use once. Many online business card printers can print a small amount of very nice business cards for less than $100. Another reason to take this chapter very seriously is that oftentimes pretexting is the very first step used by professional identity thieves. Because identity theft is taking a front row seat in the crime industry of late, knowing what it is and how to identify it is important for consumers, businesses, and security professionals. If you are a security auditor, you must help your clients become aware of these threats and test them for possible weaknesses. Summary. In addition to extensively covering pretexting and providing real-world examples of pretexting in action, this chapter also continually brushed up against the psychological principles that affect different aspects of pretexting. The logical next step on the framework covers just that. The mental skills that professional social engineers use that make them seem like mind control masters, and that give each social engineer a huge leg up in success. Chapter 5. Mind Tricks. Psychological principles used in social engineering. It all depends on how we look at things, and not on how they are themselves. Carl Gustav Jung. In Hollywood movies and television shows, con men and law enforcement are portrayed with almost mystical talents. They have the ability to get away with anything. They seem to be able to just look into the eyes of a person and tell if they are lying or telling the truth. It is not uncommon to see situations like this. The cop looks into the eyes of the suspect and can automatically tell whether he is lying or telling the truth. Or, with just the power of suggestion, the con man's targets are handing over their life savings. Movies might have you believing that manipulation tactics and getting people to do anything you want is plausible or even easy. Are these scenarios really fiction? Is it possible to gain such abilities that are saved for fantasy in the movies? This chapter could be a book unto itself, but I will condense this information down to principles that will truly change the way you interact with people. Some of the topics in this chapter are based on research done by the brightest minds in their respective fields. The techniques discussed in these topics were tested and put through the paces in social engineering environments. For example, the topic of micro-expressions is based on the research of the world-renowned psychologist and researcher Dr. Paul Ekman, who used his genius to develop techniques into reading facial expressions that can literally change the way law enforcement, governments, doctors, and everyday people interact with others. Some of the principles of Richard Brandler and John Grinder, the originators of neuro-linguistic programming, changed people's understanding about thought patterns and the power of words. These topics are subjects for much debate, and this chapter attempts to demystify this subject and explain how you can use them in social engineering. Some of the best interrogators on the planet developed training and frameworks to help law enforcement learn how to effectively interrogate suspects. These principles have such deep psychological roots that learning the methods used can literally unlock the doors to the minds of your targets. Using cues that people give in their speech, gestures, eyes, and faces can make you appear to be a mind reader. This chapter examines these skills and explains them in detail so they can be utilized by a professional social engineer. Rapport is often a word used by sales trainers and salespeople, but it is a very important aspect of gaining trust and displaying confidence. Knowing how to instantly develop rapport with people is a skill that truly enhances the skill set of a social engineer, and this chapter shows you how. This chapter finishes with my own personal research on how you can use these skills to hack the human mind. A buffer overflow is a program usually written by a hacker to execute code of malicious intent normally through the normal use of a host program. When executed, the program does what the hacker wants. What if it were possible to run commands on the human mind that would cause the target to do what you ask, give over information you seek, and in essence, prove that the human mind is able to be manipulated? This powerful information, of course, can be used for very malicious intentions. My goal in releasing this information to the public in this way is to pull back the curtain from what the bad guys are doing by exposing their methods, thinking, and principles, then analyzing each one and showing what you can learn from it. Exposing these techniques makes identifying, defending, and mitigating against these attacks easier for everyone. This chapter is truly a mind-altering collection of data and principles. Following, studying, and researching the methods will not just enhance any security endeavors, but these principles can also alter the way you communicate and interact with others. By no means, though, is this chapter a complete collection that covers all aspects of each of these skills. I provide tips to where you can find more information and programs to help you enhance these skills. This chapter sets a foundation as well as acts like a guide, pointing you in a direction so you can learn to enhance each skill over time. Learning social engineering skills is not a quick process, so don't be impatient. The methods of learning some of these skills can take years to perfect, and a lot of practice to even become proficient. Of course, you may possess a skill for a certain aspect, but if you do not, don't become impatient with trying to learn it. Keep on trying harder and practicing, and you will get it. Before you get into the meat of this chapter, the following section sets the stage for why and how these principles work. You must understand the modes of thinking that exist. After you understand more clearly how people take in and process information, you can begin to understand the emotional, psychological, and physical representations of that process. Modes of thinking. To alter someone's way of thinking, you must understand the way people think and in what modes they think. This seems a logical first step to even attempting this aspect of social engineering. You might think you need to be a psychologist or a neurologist to understand the many aspects of how a person can think. Although that can help, it is not necessary. With a little research and some practical application, you can delve into the inner workings of the human mind. In August of 2001, the FBI put out a law enforcement bulletin that made a few very profound statements on the modes in which people think. Simply confirming your nonverbal behavior to the client, using language from the client's preferred representational system, and matching speech, volume, tone, and area of speech often overcomes client reluctance to communicate. This simple statement has a lot of depth in it. Basically, it is saying that if you can first figure out the target's dominant mode of thinking and then confirm it in subtle ways, you can unlock the doors of the target's mind and help him actually feel at ease when telling you even intimate details. Logically, you may ask then, how do I figure out a target's dominant mode of thinking? Even asking people what their mode of thinking is will not offer a clear answer, because many people do not know what mode of thinking they often reside in. Due to that, as a social engineer, you must have some tools to help you determine this mode and then quickly switch gears to match that mode. A clear and easy path exists to this answer, but you need to know the basics first. The senses. For centuries, philosophers have argued the value of perception. Some go so far as to say that reality is not real, but just what our senses build into our perceptions. Personally, I do not subscribe to that idea. but I believe that the world is brought to our brain by our senses. People interpret those senses for their perception of reality. In the traditional classification, we have five senses: sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. People tend to favor one of these senses, and that is the one that is dominant. It is also the way people tend to remember things. As one exercise to determine your dominant sense, close your eyes and picture yourself waking up this morning. What is the first thing you remember? Was it the feeling of the warm sun on your face? Or maybe you remember the sound of the voice of your spouse or children calling you. Do you remember clearly the smell of coffee downstairs? Or quite possibly the bad taste in your mouth, reminding you that you need to brush your teeth? Of course, this science is not exact, and realizing what your dominant sense is may take a few tries to figure out. I once talked to a couple about this concept, and it was interesting to watch their expressions. The wife first remembered waking up and seeing the clock, and then worrying that she was running late, whereas the husband first remembered rolling over and not feeling his wife next to him. After some more questions, it became evident that the husband was a kinesthetic, or his dominant sense was feeling, whereas his wife was very visual. Of course, walking up to your target and saying, "Close your eyes and tell me the first thing you remember this morning," doesn't seem reasonable. Unless, of course, your pretext is the family shrink. You might meet with some opposition on this route. How can you determine, without going through an embarrassing interrogation about their morning rituals, what a target's dominant sense is? The three main modes of thinking. Although we have five senses, the modes of thinking are associated with only three of them. Sight, or visual thinker. Hearing, or an auditory thinker. Feeling, or a kinesthetic thinker. Each sense has a range within which it works, or a sub-modality. Is something too loud or too soft? Too bright or too dark? Too hot or too cold? Examples of these are as follows. Staring at the sun is too bright. Jet engines are too loud. And negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit is too cold. Ivan Pavlov ran an experiment where he rang a bell every time he fed a dog. In the end, the dog would hear the sound of the bell, then salivate. What most people don't know is that he was more interested in the physical and emotional aspect of submodalities. The interesting point is that the louder the bell rang, the more the dog salivated. The range change of the submodality produced a direct physical change. Pavlov's research and all of his lectures are discussed in much detail at www.ivanpavlov.com. Even though people are different from dogs, Pavlov's research is very important in understanding how a person thinks. Many of us can think of all three modes, but we dominate in one. One rings the loudest. Even within our dominant mode, we might have varying degrees of depth for that dominant sense. Following, I will discuss some of the details of each of these modes in more depth. Visual. The majority of people are usually visual thinkers, in that they usually remember what something looked like. They remember the scene clearly, the colors, the textures, the brightness or darkness. They can clearly picture a past event and even build a picture for a future event. When they are presented with material to decide upon, they often need something to see because visual input is directly linked to decision making. Many times a visual thinker will make a decision based on what is visually appealing to him, regardless of what is really better for him. Although men tend to be visual, this does not mean that all men are always visual. That visual marketing or visual aspects normally appeal to men is true. But do not assume all men are visual. A visual person often uses certain words in his speech, such as, "I see what you mean," "That looks good to me," "I get the picture now." And the range that the dominant sense works in, for a visual thinker, can have certain characteristics or sub-modalities, such as light, bright or dim, size, small or large, color, black and white, or color. Movement, fast or slow, focus, clear or hazy. Trying to debate, sell, negotiate, manipulate, or influence a visual thinker with no visual input is very difficult, if not impossible. Visual thinkers need visual input to make decisions. Auditory thinkers. Auditory thinkers remember the sounds of an event. They remember that the alarm was too loud or the woman whispered too low. They recall the sweetness of the child's voice or the scary bark of the dog. Auditory people learn better from what they hear and can retain far more from being told things than being shown things. Because an auditory thinker remembers the way something sounded, or because the sounds themselves help recall memories, he may use phrases such as, loud and clear. Something tells me, that sounds okay to me. And the range of this dominant sense can be within these submodalities. Volume, loud or soft. Tone, bass or treble. Pitch, high or low. Tempo, fast or slow. Distance, near or far. It is imperative to choose your words carefully with auditory thinkers. The words they hear will make or break the deal. I have seen whole encounters go from great to disaster with one wrong spoken word to an auditory thinker. Kinesthetic. Kinesthetic thinkers are concerned with feelings. They remember how an event made them feel, the warmth of the room, the beautiful breeze on their skin, how the movie made them jump out of their seat with fear. Often, kinesthetic thinkers feel things with their hands to get the sense of the objects. Merely telling them something is soft isn't as real as letting them touch it. But helping recall a soft item they touched before can recall emotions and feelings that are very real to a kinesthetic thinker. The term kinesthetic relates to tactile, visceral, and a sense of self-sensations of the body. Basically, where a person's body is in space and the self-awareness of how something made him feel. A kinesthetic thinker uses phrases such as, I can grasp that idea. How does that grab you? I'll get in touch with you. I just wanted to touch base. How does this feel? And the range for this type can have the following submodalities. Intensity, strong or weak. Area, large or small. Texture, rough or smooth. Temperature, hot or cold. Weight, heavy or light. Helping a kinesthetic thinker recall a feeling or emotion tied to something can make those emotions reappear as real as the first time they occurred. Kinesthetic thinkers are probably the most difficult for non-kinesthetic thinkers to deal with because they do not react to sights and sounds, and social engineers have to get in touch with their feelings to communicate with this type of thinker. Understanding these basic principles can go a long way toward being able to quickly discern the type of person you are talking to. Again, without asking the target to picture his morning rituals, how can you discern the dominant sense? Even more so, why is it so important? Discerning the dominant sense. The key to determining someone's dominant sense is to try to introduce yourself. Start a small conversation and pay close attention to what is being said. As you walk up to the target and lean in to say good morning, maybe she barely looks at you. She might be rude, or she just might not be a visual. Visuals need to look at the person speaking to communicate properly. So this behavior would seem to lend to the fact she is not visual. Now ask a simple question such as, do you just love the feel of a beautiful day like today? And notice her response, particularly whether she seems to light up or not. Maybe you wear a large, shiny silver ring. As you talk, you gesture. Maybe you see the ring catches her eye. Does she reach out, interested, and need to hold the ring or get close to observe it? Kinesthetics are very touchy-feely when it comes to these things. I know a woman who is a strong kinesthetic. and when she sees something she thinks is soft or high quality, she must touch it. She will say, "Wow, that sweater looks so soft." From that statement, one might assume she is a visual. But what happens next is what solidifies it. She then walks up to the person and touches the sweater and feels it. This shows her dominant sense is kinesthetic. The same woman must touch everything in the grocery store when she shops, whether she needs it or not. By touching the objects, she makes a connection. And that connection makes it real to her. Often she cannot remember things very well that she did not come into physical contact with. Asking questions that contain some of the key dominant words, observing target's reactions, and listening can reveal what dominant sense he or she uses. Listening for key words such as see, look, bright, dark can lead you to treat a target like a visual. As mentioned earlier, this is not an exact science. There isn't a general rule that states if a person says, "I can see what you're saying," then he is always a visual. Each clue should lead you down the path toward verifying your hunch with more questions or statements. One word of caution. Talking to someone in a different mode than they think in can be irritating to some. Using questions to determine a person's mode of thinking can be off-putting. Use questions sparingly and rely more on observation. Why understanding the mode is important. I once worked with a guy, Tony, who could sell a cup of water to a drowning man. Tony was a big believer in seeking out and then using a person's dominant sense in sales. He had a few methods that he used that you may learn from. When he first engaged the target, he had a very shiny silver and gold pen he would hold in his hand. He would gesture a lot and notice whether the person followed the pen with her eyes. If she did slightly, Tony would continually make the gestures bigger to see whether her eyes followed. If that didn't seem to work in the first few seconds, he would click the pen open and closed. It wasn't a loud noise, but loud enough to disrupt a thought and draw someone's attention if she were an auditory. If he thought that was working, he would click it with every important thought, causing the target to have a psychological reaction to the sound and what was being said. If that didn't seem to work, he would reach out over the table and tap her wrist or forearm, or if he was close enough, touch her shoulder. He didn't touch excessively, but enough to see whether she would shy away or seemed overly happy or disturbed by the touch. With these subtle methods, he could quickly discern what the person's dominant sense most likely was. This whole act would take under 60 seconds. After he found the information he was looking for, he would then start to move his conversation to that dominant sense, even taking on the traits of that sense in the words he spoke and way he acted and reacted to the conversation. One thing about Tony is that he outsold any person I have ever met. People would often say about him, "It is like he knew exactly what I needed." Tony would talk to the person and treat the person the way they wanted to be talked to. If the person was a visual thinker, Tony would use phrases like, "Can you see what I'm saying?" or "How does this look to you?" He would use illustrations that involved seeing things or visualizing scenarios. He would put people in their comfort zone. People feel at ease when they are in their comfort zone. The more you can do as a social engineer to put people in their comfort zone, the better chance you have at success. People gravitate towards those with whom they are comfortable. It is human nature. For example, if someone makes you feel warm and fuzzy or seems to understand what you are saying or seems to see where you are coming from, you easily open up to trust and let that person in your circle. I want to reiterate this point. Finding and using someone's dominant sense is not an exact science. A social engineer should use it as a tool in the arsenal and not rely on it as something magical or scientific. Certain psychological aspects of human nature are based on proven science and can be relied upon. As a matter of fact, some of these aspects are so impressive that they can make you seem like a mind reader. Some of them have been a topic of serious debate, and some accepted by psychologists, law enforcement, and social engineers for years. The next section of this chapter discusses these, starting with microexpressions. Microexpressions. You are probably familiar with the idea of reading facial expressions. When someone is happy, sad, angry, or whatever, when someone feels it, you can look at his or her face and see that emotion. What if someone tries to fake that expression, like a fake smile? We've all done it, walking through the market and bumping into someone we just don't like that much. We put on a smile and say, "Hey, John, nice to see you. Say hi to Sally." We may act very pleasant and cordial, but inside, we are feeling nothing but irritation. The expressions that we show for longer periods of time on our face are called macro expressions and are generally easier for people to see the emotion that is being conveyed. Similar to micro expressions, macro expressions are controlled by our emotions, but are not involuntary, and often can be faked. A certain few pioneers into the study of human behavior have spent decades researching something coined micro-expressions to understand how humans relay emotions. Micro-expressions are expressions that are not easily controllable and occur in reactions to emotions. An emotion triggers certain muscular reactions in a face, and those reactions cause certain expressions to appear. Many times, these expressions last for as short as 1/25th of a second. Because they are involuntary muscular movements due to an emotional response, they are nearly impossible to control. This definition is not a new understanding either. Charles Darwin wrote a book in 1872 called The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. In this book, Darwin noted the universal nature of facial expressions and how muscles were used in facial expressions. In the early 1960s, two researchers, Haggard and Isaacs, first discovered what today is called microexpressions. In 1966, Haggard and Isaacs outlined how they discovered these micro-momentary expressions in their publication titled Micro-Momentary Facial Expressions as Indicators of Ego Mechanisms in Psychotherapy. Also in the 1960s, William Condon, a pioneer who studied hours of tapes, frame by frame, discovered that humans had micro-movements. He also heavily researched neuro-linguistic programming, more on that later, and body language. Probably one of the most influential researchers in the field of micro-expressions is Dr. Paul Ekman. Dr. Ekman pioneered micro-expressions into the science it is today. Dr. Ekman has been studying microexpressions for more than 40 years, receiving the Research Scientist Award as well as being labeled one of Time Magazine's most influential people on Earth in 2009. Dr. Ekman researched facial expressions with psychologist Sylvan Tompkins. His research revealed that, contrary to popular belief, emotions are not culturally determined, but are universal across cultures and biological. Working with Dr. Maureen O'Sullivan, he developed a project called the Wizards Project. He began to pioneer the use of microexpressions in lie detection. He used a base of 15,000 people from all walks of life and all cultures and found out, of that large number, that only 50 had the ability to spot a deception without training. In the 1970s, Dr. Ekman developed FACTS, Facial Action Coding System, to label and number each conceivable human expression. His work branched out to not only include facial expressions, but also how the whole body was involved in deception. By 1972, Dr. Ekman had identified a list of expressions that were linked with basic or biologically universal emotions. Anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness, surprise. Dr. Ekman's work began to take on the following, and many law enforcement and corporate environments began to use this research in detecting deception. In 1990, in a paper entitled Basic Emotions, Dr. Ekman revised his original list to include a range of positive and negative emotions. Dr. Ekman has published many books on emotions, facial expressions, and lie detection that can help each person to understand the value in being able to decode facial expressions. This brief history indicates